Okay, folks, I'm going to start. I want to cover a lot of material here. I'm going to ignore the rabbinic principle of tefasta meruba lo tefasta. If you try to do too much, you don't get to do anything. It's a rare occasion where I'm able to speak to such a group of people who are involved in education, serious students, serious lovers of Tanakh, so it's a chance to try to do as much as possible. So we're going to try to do that. This is actually a chapter I'm writing in the next volume of a series. If you have one, you haven't written the second one, so I don't know if it's a series yet, but I wrote a book on Breishit called Redeeming Relevance in the Book of Genesis, and I'm working on writing a sequel for nothing less than the Book of Shemot. And what was said in the panel discussion, no, it wasn't panel discussion, it was Rabbi Tzvi Blanchard mentioned that many of us like to write about Breishit and Shemot because there's narrative in it, it's a lot of fun, and when it comes to law, we chicken out, and I think I'm actually planning on chickening out when we get to Vayikra. So eventually it's on the agenda, but it's not what I'm looking to do after Shemot. In any case, I'm going to ask you to try to figure out who I'm talking about. And perhaps if you looked at the title, you might already know the answer, but it actually worked out very well. I gave a similar talk, but much shorter, over Shabbat, and the title was basically the same title, and the exercise worked perfectly, so I'll see if we have the same result today. But listen carefully. Who am I describing? Okay, I'm describing someone. After growing up in a privileged and sheltered environment, the hero runs away from a more powerful member of his household, who has made clear his intention to kill him. The hero goes east, ends up by a well, where his future wife faces an obstacle in watering her sheep. The hero removes the obstacle and waters the sheep for her. Quickly, her father hears about this and takes in the hero, giving him his daughter as a wife and making him a shepherd over his flock. Eventually, after having children, he tells his father-in-law that he wants to return home. God speaks to the hero and he returns home to become leader of his clan. On the way back, he meets an otherworldly stranger who attacks him but ultimately relents. This is followed by a reunion with his older brother, who markedly embraces him in spite of the fact that the hero's return spells out a threat to the older brother's position of leadership. Okay, who is I describing?
Jacob.
Okay. Yeah, okay. The right answer is both. The right answer is both. And when I did it over Shabbat, it was perfect. Half the crowd said Moshe and half the crowd said Yaakov, and they were arguing with each other. I couldn't have asked for a better result. In any case, the point is that it's both. I'll read it again just for those who are thinking of one rather than the other. You can fill in, I'll help you fill in the details, right? Privilege and sheltered environment, Yitzhak takes care of Yaakov, there's not much going on, right? He's a Yoshev Ohalim, right? Paro's palace, certainly a sheltered and privileged environment. Heroes runs away from a more powerful member of the household, be it Esav, be it Paro, who wants to kill him. Heroes goes east, right? East doesn't have to be east of Israel. East can also be east of Mitzrayim, right? Midian is east of Mitzrayim. Ends up by a well. Obstacle, right? There are two types of obstacle. One is a rock. The other one is unfriendly shepherd. Removes the obstacle, waters the sheep. Father hears about it, takes in the hero. Rest is pretty much straightforward. The mysterious stranger, right? We know the wrestling of Yaakov, but we also know this story that was described before, the Malon story, very strange story, which we'll get to in a little bit later, where Moshe seems to be attacked. It's unclear, but certainly he's encounters this very strange stranger who ultimately relents, followed by a meeting with his older brother, Aaron or Esav, both of whom embrace their younger brother, and both of whom face a challenge in leadership upon the return of their brother. So what you have here is an uncanny extended narrative analogy. As far as I know, I mean, there are narrative analogies, there are quite a few throughout the Tanakh, but as far as I know, there's no narrative analogy that runs so for so long and through so many different stories. Again, some of the details are a little bit different, but the basic narrative, the core narrative, is almost exactly the same, right? Both of this occurs in the same periods of the hero's lives, more or less. Essentially the maturation, the young adult, early adulthood period of their lives. And the question that we need to address is, what is the Torah trying to communicate to us by telling us about these events in both these people's lives? Or if you want to frame it differently, historically, why these two heroes go through such similar processes in their lives. In other words, Avram didn't go through this. Yeah, one or two of the events may have been common to Avram as well. Yitzhak didn't go through this whole process. And later on in Jewish history, David and Shlomo, again, Yosef, Yehuda, they don't go through these events. So what is the Torah trying to do in repeating the stories? When we have a story repeat, and not only in Jewish literature, but in general literature as well, one of the things that can be accomplished is to make us notice similar functions or similar situations that we would not have otherwise seen. In other words, the Torah might be telling us that Moshe and Yaakov are similar in ways we had not or would not have thought of. Anybody want to suggest in what way Moshe and Yaakov play similar roles in their lives? Yeah.
Well, Yaakov is the first leader who is basically taking an emerging nation, it's coming out of the family or clan tribe. So I think Moshe is one who extends that to the nation.
Okay. Yeah.
Well, what we have, when you have two, it's like connecting two dots to form a line in a way. And we're basically establishing criteria for leadership.
Okay. And once you have two, that creates the criteria that I'm not sure.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. In other words, it's the two that define it create something uniform, mm-hmm. so that we understand basically what leadership is.
Okay, I would try to combine what both of you have said and say that yes, there is criteria for leadership, but I would say it's a certain type of leadership, because I think we have other leaders who have different styles, such as Yehuda and Yosef, who significantly are in between Yaakov on one hand, Moshe on the other. But I think what we're talking about here is a formative leadership. As you mentioned before, Yaakov creates the Jewish people on a physical level, on a demographic level. We need a body mass, you need enough people. Avram's not able to accomplish that. Yitzchak's not able to accomplish that. Yaakov is more successful, and he creates the basis for the tribal system, the 12 tribes. Moshe Rabbeinu needs no elaboration. He sets up the ideological framework, the religious framework of the Jewish people, which make the Jewish people into what it is. So in terms of formative leadership, it appears that there's a necessity to go through this experience. The question is, how do we define this experience? How can we describe it? What's it made up of? I think the key words here, and at least one of them was in the title, I think I used the word alienation. But before you get to alienation, the way to get to alienation is through exile. And this is something that, again, not all of our forefathers go through. And even the ones that go through it in different ways. David, by the way, does go through exile similar to these people. And perhaps that's not coincidental. But again, the details are very different in terms of David. Abraham has a more limited exile. Yitzchak has no exile, right? But this very pronounced, what I would call a hyper-exile, only exists by Moshe and by Yaakov. What do I mean by hyper-exile? In both situations, you have people who are leaving on their own. For example, suppose to Abraham, anybody who has looked at Jewish history, one of the things that's allowed us to stay on as a nation is exile has been experienced communally. In other words, the Jews went into Mitzrayim as a group. Jews came to America as a group. And when you come as a group, you're able to create some sort of island of cultural identity within the host community. In other words, on the Lower East Side, you're able to speak Yiddish, right? You're able to continue Shabbat observance without too much. I mean, obviously, there were serious battles that needed to be waged for Shabbat observance. But nonetheless, it's certainly easier to keep Shabbat observance on the Lower East Side. Someone told me that their family moved to West Virginia from New York, and it was very difficult to keep the rigors of halachic observance because you don't have the community of reinforcement, the cultural norms surrounding you that this is what people do. It's not what people do. You know, if you're in West Virginia, people don't keep Shabbat because most people are not Jewish, and even if they're Jewish, the few that are not observant Jews. So both Yaakov and Moshe go to exile on their own. As a result, their exile includes marrying ultimately foreign women, even Yaakov's relative, people presumably he had never met and probably not even really heard about in any significant capacity. They work with property that's not their own, which again, if you think about the way things were done generally, certainly with wealthy families as our forefathers belonged to, this was not something that you did. You didn't hire yourself out as a wage earner, which at least in Marxian terms is alienation of a different type when you have to sell your physical efforts. They live alongside cultural values and presumably language that they're not familiar with either. That's driven home by Yaakov's discussion with Lavan when he's given Leah instead of Rachel. Anybody remember what Lavan says to him? Good, excellent. Leah sechen b'mikomeinu. That's not what we do in our place. What's Yaakov's response? That's a trickier question. Nothing. Silence. Right. In Tanakh, in Jewish tradition, we have a principle of shtika kehoda adami, which means that when you're quiet, it means that you agree. Certainly, I mean, it's common sense. If you're arguing with someone and you let them have the last word, it means that you don't have an argument back. That's right. And therefore, when Yaakov is told, that's not how we do it here. Again, whether it was a ruse or not, it's not important for our purposes. You know, whether that really was the custom, wasn't the custom. The point is, Yaakov had to be told and could be fooled if it wasn't true that this is not what we do here, right? Because you don't know what we do here. We have mores, and Yaakov would say, "Well, the truth is, I don't know what you do here, and why should he? He wasn't from there." Yeah. It's not voluntary. Exile, on the contrary, exile is harsher. Sorry?
There's a difference there between.
Moshe's also running away. They're both running away. Moshe wasn't sent. You're right. Moshe runs away on his own initiative. And Yaakov is sent, but he's sent as a result of similar variables. In any case, so you have this really difficult exile situation which leads to alienation. It's a very. And if anyone has read Chaim Sabato's recent book, Aleppo Tales, and there's some very beautiful stories in there about Jews from Syria moving to Israel and the Chachamim, older Chachamim, who are so respected in their country, and the sense of alienation that they feel. It's bittersweet. Chaim Sabato has his tremendous love for Israel, and he shows it in his writing. But there's the bittersweet discussion or narrative that comes through over there with these Chachamim who knew and were known come to Israel and become, he writes about, you know, it's not just the Syrians, he talks about Hasidic rabbis who come to Israel and they had a whole kloyes, court, and they come to Israel and they can't even get a minyan. That sense of alienation is something that is part and parcel of moving. It doesn't even have to be exile. I mean, here we're talking about aliyah. But Quite simply, when a person moves to a foreign environment, one becomes alienated in two ways, by the way. And again, the American Jewish experience bears witness to this, that one gets alienated from the host, or one is naturally alienated from the host culture, in the sense that, you know, you move to Scotland and all the men are wearing dresses, it's very difficult. You don't put on a dress right away, it doesn't feel right. On the other hand, you slowly get alienated from your own culture as well, as many Jews who moved to the United States became more critical about their culture because it paid to do so. In other words, the host culture would welcome you better if you adopted the values and the mores of the host culture. So alienation is a process that comes with exile. It's a natural process. It's not only the stuff of Jewish history, it's the stuff of human history. And nations swallow up other nations, people move from one country to another. And the immediate result is some level of alienation. For some it's worse than others, for some communities, depends how diverse, how much tension there is between the host culture and the ancestral culture. We can get back to this theme. I want to focus on two specific aspects of this alienation, focusing more on Moshe, but I think this is true, at least the first point is true of Yaakov as well. One of the elements that I spoke about in terms of the alienation is the work situation. Yaakov and Moshe are both shepherds for their father-in-law. Now the motif of Jewish leader, the motif and the foreshadowing of Jewish leader as a shepherd is one that occurs quite frequently, right? It's not that we can think of many other examples, right? You have the sons of Yaakov, you have Tzipora, Rachel, David, and there's many, many others, right? Commentaries, especially but many commentaries speak about this specifically with Moshe, the Kli Yakar, the Nitziv, Rabbeinu Bachya, the Barvanel also speak about this issue that quite frequently we have a metaphor that's been created in terms of foreshadowing the person's future role, right? In which the metaphor that's created, the sheep is clearly the Jewish people, right? And the shepherd is the leader, but the shepherd is not, it's not his flock. Whose flock is he guarding? Or is she guarding? Yeah, but in terms of the nimshal, of the mashal, not the nimshal. He's guarding his father's flock, right? And the nimshal, the father is of course God. So it works very, very nicely, right? The pattern works very well. Father is God, the shepherd is the Jewish leader, and the sheep are the Jewish people. This mashal breaks down in the case of Moshe and Yaakov. Right? So all of a sudden, we're dealing with someone who's not tending the sheep of his or her father. He's tending the sheep. The fact that his father-in-law is similar, but is quite different, especially we see it spelled out, the implications spelled out in the case of Lavan. When you're tending your father's sheep, certainly in the ancient world, essentially you're tending your own sheep. In other words, the value that's created, right, as with Yaakov, automatically becomes yours. It's your estate. In other words, not immediately, but eventually you inherit the estate. Right? The father-in-law's possessions, as I said before, are essentially an employee-employer relationship. And again, I think there's no accident, besides the alienation issue that exists here, as part of this general theme of alienation, I think we have a more specific notion that's being expressed, and that is Moshe and Yaakov. Again, focusing more on Moshe as the formational Jewish leader, ideally not being the son of the owner of the sheep, right? But rather being some sort of middleman, of being a manager, which on some level is counterintuitive. I mean, anybody who knows about investments knows that it's better to hire someone to invest your money than doing it yourself. Why? Because if you're doing it yourself, you get very nervous. You're not necessarily the one who's going to do the best with your own interest. And therefore, on a practical level, it makes sense to hire a manager as opposed to doing the managing yourself. But it's only on a practical level. I think there's something much more profound going on over here. And that is that the ideal position of a supreme Jewish leader, again, a formative Jewish leader, is one that has to be divorced from God. The wrestling of Yaakov and the stranger that we spoke about, Moshe, I think is not coincidental. We want a leader who can articulate his vision separately from God. I think here you have the principle. Again, I'm going rather quickly because we don't have a lot of time, but the principle of Lo B'Shamayim Hi, the idea that a Jewish leader has to be, and again, we're not talking about a run-of-the-mill Jewish leader, we're talking about the leaders of the generation, has to articulate the needs of the Jewish people to God in his own vision, right? And vice versa, has to articulate the needs of God to the Jewish people from his perspective. Right? There's a need that's being communicated here for someone who is so intimately connected to God to be independent. That's what's required from a Jewish perspective from this type of leader, specifically because we might think otherwise and we might say that a Jewish leader on this level is simply supposed to be some sort of robot, some sort of shaliach, if you will, some sort of messenger of God who takes no independent stand. But we see from the argumentation, again, Moshe from the very beginning is a person that argues with God. From the beginning of his mission in Perek Hey in Shemot, right, there's this very strange argument which in other situations one would assume would disqualify Moshe from the leadership. That here he is, he has the chutzpah to argue according to our tradition for 7 days with God. How can such a person be identified with the mantle of Jewish leadership par excellence? But in fact, I think the Torah is trying to tell us something unintuitive, that such is exactly what's desired from a Jewish leader, someone who's going to intervene and try, as Moshe does many, many times, to intervene on behalf of the people. That's a theme, by the way, we see earlier, but I think it shows itself most clearly in the cases that we're talking about. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is a contrast to Moshe, where like yes, he initiates the he initiates the leaving of the Laban's house.
Mm-hmm.
He initiates the gift and the encounter with Esav and has the encounter with the Malach. But if you look at Yaakov's character and his entire story, even after Vayishla from that encounter, he really is presented as a very passive character. And that the leadership position that really emerged, whether it's positive or negative leadership, are really shown through his son.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's a good question. I'm not sure it's as clear as that. I think that there's a tremendous transformation that exists in Yaakov's life. Passivity or lack of action is not necessarily a function of lack of leadership. For example, the Dina story where he appears to be passive, I'm not sure is an issue of passivity as much as a decision to take a more pacifistic stance than his sons. I mean, what happens is a usurpation of usurping of the leadership that is rightly his. There's a development, but what I think is true is Yaakov is essentially the small Moshe. In other words, Yaakov is this idea, small characters, and Moshe is the one who expresses this in its fullness, because ultimately the formation of the Jewish people is much more that of Moshe than it is of Yaakov. But it's a good question. I'm not answering it fully.
So you think Moshe is Yaakov rewritten?
On some level, yeah, yeah. Okay, I want to get to another theme, and then I'm going to discuss the issue of alienation and exile in general in Jewish tradition. And this is a distinction. I mean, in narrative analogies, a lot of times we don't only look at what's the same, but also what are the differences. Within the differences in the two stories, one can also understand a certain meaning being transmitted. And there are various differences, one of which I'm not going to address is the difference in the role of their fathers-in-law. Obviously, Lavan is a very antagonistic character, whereas Yitro is certainly more of a positive figure in that story. And there are things that come out of that. But that's for another time, another study. The thing that is most interesting to me in this context of alienation is the relationship between Yaakov and his family, meaning his wife and children, or wives and children, and the relationship between Moshe and his wife and children. Here you have a very strong difference that's spelled out. Again, I think the reason, because Yaakov is a small Moshe and Moshe is the Moshe in big, but let's just look through what the differences are. And not so much in the context of Yaakov. Yaakov's story with all the interesting details is on some level similar to the story of Yitzhak and Rivka, is similar to the story of Abram and Sarah. Again, there are all sorts of differences, but I'm saying there's a description, there's a narrative, there's a sense of, with all their problems, a Jewish family. And one sees that later with other characters in Tanakh as well, though perhaps not as fully as the story of the Avot Imahot. But the story of Moshe and Tzipora is extremely strange. The story of the Malon, which was described earlier, which is, I haven't done much study in academic approaches to Tanakh, so perhaps that's why I don't know how to understand the story. But the story is very enigmatic, very terse. It's not clear who's doing what. But for our context, what's interesting is, I don't know if you realize, that's the only time in the whole Torah that that Tzipor actually speaks. And she doesn't have a lot to say either. And we don't even know what she's saying. Sorry, right?
I would think the last one she had more to say.
Yeah, fine. According to Midrashim, according to the... But in terms of the Torah itself, in terms of what the Torah tells us, absolutely nothing else. Moreover, she's almost not mentioned in Bechlal. She's mentioned two other times, right? When she mentions, she mentioned when she meets Moshe, right? When she marries Moshe. And she's mentioned when she's brought back to Moshe by her father. It's interesting that we never realize that they split. If you look at, again, the commentaries in the Midrashim fill in, but if you look at the text is almost completely silent about this very mysterious wife of Moshe. His children don't fare much better. One of them we don't even realize is born. They're referred to, appropriately enough, at least by Yitro, as Bnei Tzipora. Right? No, Bnei Tzipora, if I remember. Yeah? Yudchet Bet. Shmot Yudchet Bet. Let's check it out.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So it's Vanea. Okay. Fine. Yeah. Right. The Kaki Tzor Pasukim Et Tzipor Eshet Moshe Afashu Rav Vechne Vanea Asher Shem Echad Yosham Kamagir Hayti Bet Nochriya Shem Echad Beezer. Okay, yeah, right. So he refers to them as Banea. What's interesting is in the same context, he's referred to as Choten Moshe, right? And she's referred to as Eshet Moshe. Right? But when it comes to the children, it's Banea.
Look, but in Pasuk Hei says,
yeah, yeah. So that's very interesting, right?
But then he
Yeah, that's correct. What's interesting, by the way, Ubanav, it's not clear whose banim they are. Banav can refer to one of two people. No, Banav, his children. Right, right, right. Okay? And such a suggestion is, I mean, it's more likely they were talking about B'nai Moshe, I'll grant you. But there is a Pirush on the Targum that actually suggests that possibility is a possibility. It denies it, that it's actually talking about B'nai Yitro, not B'nai Moshe. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It would definitely work. It's definitely open, and the ambiguity may be purposeful. But in any case, the situation of Moshe and his family is very uneventful. It's very uneventful. Again, we have traditions as to them not turning out so well. But as far as the text, we hear almost nothing about them. Not about the relationship, not about how they turned out. Whatever we hear about them is very disconnected. By the way, again, in Bamidbar, and we speak about Moshe being divorced from his wife, which is not 100% clear from the text itself, it's very much in context of the relationship that we've seen up until now. We don't, as probably the first commuter marriage that ever existed, right? She's in Midian, he's in Mitzrayim. The physical separation that exists even before this possible divorce, I think, sets the tone. The fact that she doesn't exist in the Torah for all practical purposes also sets a tone where a divorce would be, or separation would be, the logical consequence or the consummation of a process that is one of separation. What one could suggest, by the way, answers. One could suggest that in Shemot we're not interested in the family lives of our heroes. We're in Bereishit. We're going through a different kufa, the family versus nation, as was suggested before. There was more of an, one could also suggest that there was more of a need in formative period for the influence of the mothers. They had more to contribute as mothers per se in that particular context. Nonetheless, with all these answers, I don't think it answers properly the fact that Moshe, who is, you know, besides God, the star of the Torah, I don't know how many times he's mentioned in the Torah, but constantly, and we hear not only about his role as a national leader, we hear about, certainly in the beginning of Shemot, his personal life as well. We hear that he was in the house of Paro and how he was born. Similar to the narratives of the Avot, it seems that simply to stress the differences between the two books is not enough to explain the lack of Kesher, the last of relationship that exists between Moshe and his family. I think in the context of the alienation that we've described of Moshe as and Yaakov, Yaakov being the small Moshe, Moshe being the big Moshe, we understand that Moshe needs to be one step higher in terms of his alienation. Many of you know that Rabbi Soloveitchik, who the book, The Lonely Man of Faith, many say, describe him, apparently. I didn't see the movie yet, but the movie by the same name apparently shows just how lonely he was existentially. But be that as it may, it's also well known that he had a very close relationship with his wife, that this seemed to be a tremendous source of sustenance for him and caused him great distress, more than, by far, than the average husband. When she died, the companionship of a wife, especially for someone who's separated, for someone who's alienated, from someone who is disconnected from his surroundings, is understandably of very deep importance. And it could be for that reason that Yaakov has this type of relationship, at least with Rachel and perhaps with some of the other wives. With Moshe, it's not there, and it appears that on some level, to be Moshe, it could not be there. At least that's my suggestion, that Moshe needed to be alienated on a level unparalleled, right? On some level, you know, we don't see people who are separating from their wives. Moshe needs to do that because he is the one who needs to be hyper-alienated. He needs to be the one to receive the Torah. Now, getting back to the theme of alienation and why Moshe needs to be hyper-alienated, I think that as the man that receives the Torah, if we understand the function of the Torah for the Jewish people, for mankind, we may understand why Moshe needs to be so separated from every level of connection. By the way, we've noticed that he's not only separated from nation, from national culture, and from his wife, but he's also even separated from God, right? In terms of the mashal that we presented to explain this wrestling that he has with God. He's not necessarily on God's side, and God's not necessarily on his side either. The Torah, we often think of as a national possession, as something that's strictly for the Jews. And for historical reasons, we've become much more insular, and we fail to realize that there is sort of a dual nature to this Torah, to this revelation that is part of the Jewish tradition. When we're asked to be a Mamlechet Kohanim, right, even though it's become a catchphrase, Mamlechet Kohanim, Vegoy Kadosh, if we look at the implication of Kohanim, right, we realize, and we don't need that to make us realize it, but if we look at it carefully, we'll realize that just as a priest is not supposed to service himself or his fellow priest, so then the Jew is not supposed to service himself or his fellow Jew. That the ultimate, if this is the ultimate purpose of the Jewish nation, then the ultimate purpose of the Jewish nation is to serve mankind. Meaning that the revelation of the Torah is meant to give laws to the Jews, but give an ethic to mankind as a whole. And in fact, on some level, the Jews did play that role in the ancient world. And if you look at Thomas Cahill's The Gifts of the Jews, one sees a tremendous influence of the ethics of the Torah and Jewish tradition on the ancient world. With the exile, as I said, for historical and sociological reasons, that ceased to be, and to this day, that's the situation that we're in. But to read the Torah and to read Jewish revelation as a national, singularly national type of possession, I think is a misreading. Certainly, the works of Rav Kook would pronounce it as such, where he takes a very keen interest in what the return to Eretz Yisrael is supposed to not only do for the Jews, but for the for mankind as well. So why does he need to be alienated, if that's in fact the case of what the Torah is all about? Because if one is only able to read history from one perspective, if one is only able to relate to one group as his brothers, then automatically one can't relate to another narrative or to another group. Meaning when we have an in-group, that automatically spells out an out-group as well. And a practical example, if you have a brother or sister that's in trouble that needs a large amount of money, so one tries to find a large amount of money because they're one's brother or sister. But if someone you never knew were to make the same request to you, most of us would not think twice because it simply would be too much of a sacrifice. There's an in-group and there's an out-group. We're sympathetic to the needs and wants of the in-group, and once that's a situation, that means in comparison to that, we're less sympathetic or not really sympathetic to the out-group. On some level, it's humanly impossible, is a different way of saying it, to give complete and total support to two competing narratives of the same story, right? Unless you're unrooted, unless you're deculturated, you're transcultural, that you don't belong in an organic sense to one group as opposed to another. And it appears that perhaps, at least my line of reasoning, and one can certainly argue, but my line of reasoning is that this was necessary for a Moshe who's going to be the standard bearer not only for the Jews but for the non-Jews, has to be seen as someone without a nationalistic bias, someone who is able to feel and hear the needs of the non-Jews in the same way as he's able to feel and hear the needs of the Jews. I think further support of that thesis is found in our rabbinic tradition with Moshe's the understanding that Moshe is the one that petitioned God for the joining of what's called the Eruv Rav, right? The non-Jews that were to join with the Jews. It's supposed to have been a debate. Again, here Moshe is disagreeing with God, saying that it's important for non-Jews to take part in the Jewish national experience. One doesn't have to be part of this family, a born Jew. One can also come from any tradition, any heritage, any nationality, and be part of the Jewish experience. So Moshe argues with God, and whatever happened to the Eruv Rav is not really relevant for this particular discussion. The point was, it was important for Moshe to have these sympathies and the willingness and the interest in the well-being of non-Jews, and not to be simply someone who's rooted in a nationalistic enterprise.
Was Yaakov interested in non-Jews?
I don't know.
Okay, so parallels.
Moshe again. Moshe is the extreme version. We saw this in the difference between their connection with their families. So Moshe needs to be the hyper experience of alienation.
What's so good about the fact that he helped play on the Iran, because that was actually had a bad effect. In other words, what is the responsibility of the leader to keep out negative elements from the people?
Yeah, absolutely. The question is, whatever a person does, there's a trade-off. And again, something that I argue in my first book on Bereishit is that you can have... We don't live in a fairy world where something can be black and white at the same time. For example... Not even chance. It's an inevitability. You know, I have a problem. Either I make Moshe into a transcultural character with all the benefits that I've described, and that means that he's going to invite people who are going to be detrimental to Jewish people, or I make him not be a trans-cultural personality, forget about the benefits, and avoid the problems. So God has to make a decision, right, as he does in many places throughout Tanakh. And he says that, yeah, it's worth having the Eruv Rav in order to have Moshe be Moshe, because that's what's needed for him. Yeah. In other words, it's the negative in that particular case. Maybe they didn't have maybe they could have lived up to Moshe's expectations. But at least in retrospect, they were a negative trade-off value for the benefit that we got from who Moshe was, which was a necessary component of the giver and the transmitter of the Torah. So Moshe needs to be not only the man as Jew, but he also needs to be the man as man. Again, if the Torah is supposed to be something that's going to be relevant and appealing, not only to the Jewish community, which appears to be the Torah's original intention. And there is a need for Moshe to be attached emotionally to the Jewish people as well. Ergo, he is born into a Jewish family, he's not a complete stranger, and he returns for his early childhood, right? He's brought back to be nursed back into his family. And one who has studied psychology, especially child psychology, know how important those first few years are, even if we don't realize them. So there is an emotional connection that's made from the womb to the Jewish people, which also has an important role to fulfill. Now, Moshe can not only be the objective bystander, because if that were to be the case, it would be too easy for Moshe to see God's side. And as when the Jews do bad, it would be too easy for Moshe to simply say, God, you're right, wipe them out, because there's no connection whatsoever. Nonetheless, it's only the early childhood, and a variable that I forgot to mention is that Moshe is not only once exiled, he's really twice exiled. He's exiled to the house of Paro, and he's exiled after that to Midian. That's right. According to the Midrash, he's actually thrice exiled. He goes somewhere else before Midian. But I think, again, the Chazal are picking up on this theme and expressing it in their way, that Moshe is completely separated from the Jewish experience. By the way, there's something else that's interesting in some discussions. I don't recall. I didn't have a chance to go over it today, but at least at some points, Moshe, in arguing with God, refuses to identify the Jewish people as his people. He speaks to Kadosh Baruch Hu, this is, we should save your people. And even when he's trying to save the Jews, he's speaking of them as God's people. God throws it back on Moshe and speaks to them as Moshe, that's right, as Moshe's people. Furthering the idea of this separation, that Moshe is part of the people, but he's not entirely part of the people, with many other tangential benefits as well. Just want to conclude, and I'll leave a few minutes for questions, with the idea of alienation in Jewish tradition in general. Again, I think it's a theme that doesn't only exist with Yaakov and Moshe, but exists in other discussions as well in Jewish tradition. The Jewish nation as a whole is characterized by a tremendous amount of national exile and resultant alienation. If you think about it, not only are we born in Chutz Laaretz, first of all, our father was born in Chutz Laaretz, Avraham Avinu was born in Chutz Laaretz, but the Jewish nation is born in Egypt or at Sinai, if you will. They're not born as a nation in Eretz Israel. Again, I don't think it's accidental. There's a lot, this theme and this motif reappears in all sorts of contexts. But not only are we born in exile, most of our life as a nation is also in exile. Even when the Jews were in Israel as a captive nation, if you put the numbers together, much fewer years than they have been in exile. It's not quite 2-to-1, but it's almost that. And if you talk about independent existence of the Jewish nation, and even some of the years that we count as independence were really vassal states. So the amount of national independence of the Jews in Israel, or anywhere for that matter, is unusually few. I mean, there's no parallel in human history, this nation that exists much more in exile than in a state of independence and state of being in their national home. It's interesting that you have Jews leading non-Jewish countries more often, starting with Yosef, but running non-Jewish countries more often than they're running their own country. Again, it's a theme that as the progenitors, as the ambassadors of a Torah, which is, again, looking at the results as well as looking at the Torah's description of what Torah is supposed to be, is understandable, because here's a nation that has a message not to itself, but primarily to mankind as a whole. And again, I think that the theme that's being expressed throughout is that in order to be able to do that, you have to be able to sympathize with the other guys. And sometimes we, in the traditional community, feel that Jews are overly sympathetic to everyone else besides ourselves, which can obviously be a problem. But I think there's some rootedness to that, that a Jew should be able to feel the plight of others, because one is naturally accustomed to the situation of being a guest in someone else's country, in a situation where one identifies not only with self, but with host as well. Finally, just a concluding thought, and I'll open it up for questions. I think the return of the Jewish state, in spite of the philosophy of Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk, has created an impediment in the possibility of our carrying on a universalistic message, a message of ethics and values to mankind as a whole. I think in the religious community in Israel, there is a tremendous insularity that's been encouraged by the fact that we're able to live among ourselves. And certainly the state of Israel, where I have the privilege to live, is a tremendous gift to us. But as we spoke about trade-offs before, there is a negative trade-off that if we don't address, and I think we can address, risks to sabotage or to undermine this value which we discussed today in the context of the need for alienation specifically addressed in the narratives of Moshe and Yaakov, as well as what we saw in Jewish history as a whole. I'll take questions. Comments? You go ahead.
Sounds like what you're saying is that there's almost a nechatzila to the gula, whereas the idea of the Jewish people being an oral domain, the ideal place, like one of the main purposes of Eretz Yisrael is to be a geographical location in which we can be the ideal oral domain, and that it shouldn't have to be dependent on us living within the context and within the geographical location of the nations that we are supposed to be influencing positively, and that I guess it would be an unfortunate situation that there's insularity, although natural there'd be insularity when we are all together in Israel. On the other hand, that is the goal,
right,
is to be all together and still like and still be the world that we need,
right,
in Israel.
Right. So oftentimes the Jews are supposed to attain a level, and when they're not able to do it, there has to be a secondary strategy. And it was, the ideal is one thing, but the way to get to that ideal is often taking, you know, the direct route to Israel from Mitzrayim is something that the Jews aren't able to achieve. So what do? They have to walk around for 40 years preparing themselves for something that ideally they should have been able to do in only a matter of days. The Jews are constantly going back into exile, according to what we're saying, because they have not fully internalized the idea that they're supposed to appreciate from their exile. In other words, that the roots of our existence are in exile, and that should ideally be enough. But so long as we don't internalize those values, then we keep on having to go back. What does that mean in terms of the future? I don't know, but at least on the ideal level, I think we have to focus on what we're meant to do. And if we're able to do that, then we can, in fact, accomplish the ideal. Yeah.
First, two quick small questions. What was the name of the book by Cagle?
By Cagle?
Cagle.
Oh.
I thought it was Cagle.
Thomas Cagle, Gifts of the Jews.
Thomas Cagle, right. Thomas Cagle, Gifts of the Jews. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
Okay, and the other question was, the other one I'll deal with after, just getting how you said something, but to ask a more general question is, so does that mean that we should train our leaders by making sure they have an alienated part of their lives? In other words, how do you take what you said
practically?
Like practical leadership.
Yeah. I think it's important for any Jewish leaders to have exposure to the non-Jewish world. Who and when and how is something that would take a long time to discuss. But I think it's important for exposure, be it personal exposure, be it mediated exposure. It's important for exposure to the positive that exists among other nations. I think it's tremendously productive. Yeah. Sorbonne, yeah, it's true, yeah.
If I'm trying to think of other examples of Moshe's leadership role where it is where he's born out, but he serves him well to be able to.
Yeah, again, I think that what we're seeing is Moshe separating himself from God as well as from family, as well as from nation. Does that always serve him well? I don't know. I don't know in the actual story. What I'm seeing is a necessity, and I'm trying to understand that necessity in a broader context.
I always looked at it more as in order for him to have a relationship that he had as far as
right, I agree. That's also, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think.
I
think what it does do for him, the separation with the people, it allows him to present a more objective leadership for his people as well. As we mentioned before, when you're investing your own money, you're not willing to take risks because you have this emotional attachment to it. Moshe Rabbeinu, I think, is able to express the best needs of the Jewish people. Granted, there are all sorts of issues that occur. I'm not sure anyone else could have done any better, but I think the fact, I mean, again, analytically speaking, it would make sense to me that I would want something, an objective leader, someone who's subjective, is always going to be indulgent with me and allow me to do whatever I want. I just want to point out that there's a weekly email that we send out from our academy. Anybody who would like to sign up is welcome to do so. There's also information about the Cardozo Academy, who's a co-sponsor of the Yemei Yun. There's also something about a blurb about my book, the first volume, which is available through Amazon. Last year there was a bookseller, but I didn't see anyone this year. So, in case, thank you very much.
So, questions?
Yeah.
The way you phrase something that's very powerful and useful. So, you want a leader to be, or Moses was powerful as a leader because he was able to articulate his vision separately from God, and then also. He was like both of is God and the people. Or those two things we talked about. There's one other quick point. There's a book called Dune. There's a book called Dune.
There's so much going on.
Frank Herbert.
Yeah.
And I was just thinking
that
the leader in that book goes through some of this. I haven't analyzed it, but I just.
Good to know.
I guess that's the root of the Jewish nation, from my word, not coincidentally.
I very much enjoyed your book.